Welcome to the Not Old Better Show. I'm your host, Paul Vogelsang. Today's show is an exciting one. It begins decades ago, but our part of it starts in 2010 with Nicholas Reynolds, a longtime American intelligence officer, former U.S. Marine colonel, and Oxford-trained historian who began to uncover clues suggesting, of all things, that Nobel Prize-winning novelist Ernest Hemingway was deeply involved in mid-20th century spycraft. This mystery, this shocking relationship that unfolds, is far more complex, sustained, and fraught with risks than has ever been previously supposed. Now, today, here with us on the Not Old Better Show, Nicholas Reynolds' meticulously researched and captivating narrative, his new book, Writer, Sailor, Soldier, Spy, looks among the shadows and finds a Hemingway not seen before. Welcome to the Not Old Better Show, CIA archivist, author, and longtime American intelligence officer, former U.S. Marine colonel, Nicholas Reynolds. Well, Nicholas Reynolds, what a pleasure it is to speak to you. Of course, you're the author of Writer, Sailor, Soldier, Spy, Ernest Hemingway's Secret Adventures. I think this is just a wonderful book. I really want to get into this. And I have to tell you right at the start, I'm a fan of Hemingway's. His bravado, his legendary manliness, his almost strident Americanism values, his toughness, his colorful side, all of that contributed to this sense of myth. And I know that many of my listeners are fans too. I gather you are a fan as well. So given all of that, how did a book like this even come about?
So yes, first of all, I am a fan. I was a fan. I am a fan. Been a fan since I was about 12 years old. In order to answer your question, and it has to do with being a fan, is I was working on something else. I was working on intelligence in World War II, and I've started pulling on that thread, partially out of curiosity because it went beyond what I was trying to do for the CIA Museum, and I picked up a book called Spies, and it was the history of KGB and NKVD espionage, Soviet espionage in the United States, mostly between 1933 and 1945. And I found an entry for Ernest Hemingway in the index, and it wasn't just a passing reference to Hemingway. It wasn't just these were the years that Hemingway wrote For Whom the Bell Tolls or went to the Spanish Civil War. It was a whole subchapter on him and Soviet espionage.
Well, you must have been shocked by some of that.
I was more than shocked. I was because this was so inconsistent. You summed up Hemingway's appeal very well at the beginning of our talk a couple minutes ago, and Ernest having anything to do with the Soviets, beyond sort of viewing them as sources and people that he encountered. And then add to that the fact that I was working at the CIA, where just about the worst thing that can happen to you is one day you find out that the guy who's working at the next desk is also working for the Soviets. I was taken aback, and what I wanted to do was get to the bottom of the story. And I thought surely somebody has dealt with this before. I mean, this fact isn't that new. And I started looking in all the Hemingway biographies and sources and articles for somebody to tell me, hey, what does this mean? As time went on, I saw more and more unusual bits of the story. Of this story that could fit into a bigger story, and wound up writing this book.
And there were almost allusions towards many during that time frame. That was kind of some of this. Hemingway's period coincides with some of the McCarthyism, the anti-American committee at the House of Representatives, maybe some even allusions to Julia Child. Do you think the Soviets saw Hemingway as a source? Did they see him as a novelist? Did they see him as a journalist? What do you think led the Soviets to Hemingway?
That's a great question. And So if you looked at Soviet espionage in this period, and what we think of first when we think of Soviet espionage, you have the Alger Hiss kind of guy. You have a government official, access to official secrets, taking those official secrets and giving them to a Soviet spy for retransmission to Moscow. And Ernest wasn't a government official. He didn't have access to official secrets. What he was was a journalist with a lot of connections. And so a journalist could have a number of uses for the Soviets. He could serve, he could induce people into the fold. He kind of as a broker, if you will, if there was someone the Soviets were interested in, he could introduce them, and he could make the introduction. He could also give the Soviets his own gloss on events. You have to remember the Soviet Union has, well, and Russia in general, has always been this more or less isolated place on the in Eastern Europe, and they knew that the United States was, or they sensed the United States was going to be a player in the coming struggle, which they saw between Nazi Germany and themselves. And they wanted to understand America. So somebody like Ernest could say, you know, this is how you want to look at a question like this. They could also send him as sort of a soft spy, if you will. They could say, could you go see so-and-so and find out what they're thinking about, you know, the war in China or something like that, or the Spanish Civil War. And he had great access. He went, he'd been to the White House. He'd spoken to the president. His wife was a good friend of Mrs. Roosevelt, which accounts for that access. On his own, he also had contacts at the highest level of the Treasury Department. So this is a guy who really who could really get around.
And of course, during that time, the Soviet Union was an ally of the United States for World War II, and so maybe there was this almost collegiality that took place. But in your research, did you ever find that Hemingway was paid any money, any cash for some of the work that he
had? No, he was not paid. He was an ideological recruit, and so by that they didn't mean that he subscribed to communist ideology, but they meant that there was some political platform on which they agreed, and that was the motivation. The political platform was anti-fascism. So at the beginning of this period, Hemingway was an ardent anti, or became an ardent anti-fascist during the Spanish Civil War, and the U.S. was neutral.
So let's jump back for just a second. You mentioned some of the Soviet files, and I'm curious about the research that you did. Was it U.S. based research? Was it CIA research? Was it Russian research? Did you get access to some of these quote unquote Russian files? How did you come upon all of this information?
Because so great, really another great question. The files that show his relationship with the Soviets are in the Library of Congress, and it's a long kind of shaggy dog story that goes back to the collapse of the Soviet Union and perestroika. When the Soviet Union collapsed, the KGB guys lost their pension plan. And so they came up with a plot, or I guess a plot's a little too strong, but not that far-fetched.
A little entrepreneurial plot, maybe.
An entrepreneurial initiative. How about that? They were going to sell old, they wanted to sell old secrets to the West and make money. And they made a couple of book deals. And the idea was to tell the history of Soviet espionage in a way that would be interesting to the West, but wouldn't betray any new secrets, if that makes sense. So, in other words, they weren't going to release the names of agents, but they were going to paint a broad brush picture of Soviet espionage. And so what they did was hire a former KGB guy to read the files. So he had access to the original files, and he was allowed to take notes by hand. And then he was required to prepare a narrative which would be vetted by a committee. And then after that, the narrative would be released to the American publisher and the American writer. And a couple of books were put out under this arrangement. And then the hardliners came back around the middle of the decade. So this process starts around 1990, ends around 1995. The hardliners come back and they say, what are you doing? They said, well, we have this idea to replenish the fund. And they said, no, we're an intelligence agency. We don't do that. And if you keep doing it, we're going to hurt you, even though they were paying this guy to do it. So what he did was leave the country and arrange for the raw material, his raw notes, to get out. And that's how we know that Hemingway had this relationship with them. That fact that he had the relationship with them was not supposed to be released because it had never been released before. They only wanted to release to the American publisher, they only wanted to release sort of stories that had already been partially known. So, you know, they might have done Alger Hiss, but they did other spies that had long since been unveiled.
We are with author Nicholas Reynolds. We're discussing his new book, Writer, Sailor, Soldier, Spy, Ernest Hemingway's Secret Adventures. I have to say, Nicholas, I've read the book. It is fascinating. It's just excellent. Of course, I really encourage all of my listeners to check this book out because it really is excellent. I think it's really interesting if you're a fan of Hemingway's too, because you almost get this foreshadowing in your book of some of the writing that Hemingway did later. And I thought that was kind of an interesting parallel. But I wonder, as a prolific writer, did Hemingway himself chronicle any of his own days as a spy? Did you find any of that in your research?
Another great question. There's a qualified answer. The answer is a qualified no. Yeah. So he and the Soviets entered into a formal relationship at the end of 1940 and the beginning of 1941. Before that, he had known the Soviets, and he'd known Soviet spies, Comintern agents, soldiers, and he had done odd jobs for them. But it wasn't a formal relationship. So you have a play that he wrote called The Fifth Column, and it features an American who looks and sounds a lot like Hemingway. His name is Rawlings, probably after Marjorie Rawlings, a writer whom he liked. And this guy is basically a counterintelligence agent. He's going around looking for fascist spies in Madrid. So that's the closest he comes to writing about intelligence. He wrote a little bit in Islands in the Stream about his time as a sub hunter, which he regarded as a form of intelligence, hunting for German submarines in the Caribbean in 1942 and 43, but that wasn't published during his lifetime. In his letters, he was a great letter writer. I learned what a great letter writer he was as I got into this project. I knew there were a couple published volumes of his letters, but how interesting, how long he would write 10 or 15 letters a day, and some of them were just a couple paragraphs, instructions to his his banker or his lawyer or whatever. And others were these wonderful excursions over a number of topics. And in those, there are some hints that if you take if you put them in context, fit in with this story. By themselves, they're kind of shoulder shrugs. But you find I found a pattern of remarks in his letters that is consistent with the story of him as an anti-fascist and as a guy who is fascinated by intelligence and likes to think of himself as a master of the trade and able to have a relationship with the Soviets on his own terms, or so he would have thought.
One of the interesting things that I found in the book, too, was this kind of tie to the Florida Keys. And yeah, you always think of Hemingway and the idyllic Keys, rum-filled, you know, just a sun-drenched setting. But that particular area, that geographic area, played a role in his almost conversion into this work as a spy. Isn't that right?
Absolutely. That's why I start the book with a hurricane.
Mm-hmm.
And that is... I do it because it is a kind of conversion experience for him, and it's a way to mark the difference between the old Hemingway, who's a cross between apolitical and libertarian sounding. Mm-hmm. He didn't really have a political philosophy; he had political attitudes. It's kind of like "leave me alone" would be his. That would you could sum up his pre-1935 political views as leave me alone, don't tax me so much. And after 1935, it's, there's a pronounced shift to the left, and then there's the anti-fascism, and it starts in the hurricane where he sees big government, happens to be the Roosevelt administration, but it could have been the Hoover administration. He sees them abusing the vets who are down there working on a highway project. And it's kind of an extension of the bonus march that happened in the Hoover administration. Anyway, that's a pronounced turn to the left, and feeds right into the anti-fascism, and it's picked up by the Soviets. So it appears in a hard left journal called New Masses. Not everyone who wrote for the New Masses or appeared on the masthead of New Masses was a communist, but there were a fair number of them, and it was also on Moscow's reading list. So the NKVD goes, hey, we didn't know Hemingway thought like this. It's a blistering denunciation of kind of the American establishment, and they sort of go, well, I wonder if there's something to Hemingway, and then so they clip the story and pop it into a kind of Hemingway file. As far as I could tell, Hemingway's not a target at this point. It's just kind of like, well, this is interesting, and then they. That's what intelligence services do. They maintain files of ops leads, and then maybe one day somebody acts on them, or maybe the lead turns out to be not so promising after a few years. Basically, after the hurricane in the Keys, he goes into a Soviet ops leads file, and that feeds into the main story.
One of the other interesting things that I found in some of my research on you and the book was this almost 007 spy versus spy Hemingway that came up with this way to weaponize highlight players. And I wonder if you could tell that story real quick, because it's a good one.
Okay,
I don't want to take too much away from the book, but that, I thought that was just very, very clever. So.
I think that's a great little story within a larger story. So, highlight players, that's kind of a dangerous form of squad racket ball played with a hard ball, but instead of a racket, you use kind of a launching device attached to your hand that's called a basket. There were Basque emigres who had been anti-fascists in Spain living in Havana, and Hemingway recruited them to serve on his cabin cruiser Pilar as she hunted for German submarines. And the idea was, if they ever got close enough to a German submarine, these guys would try and launch hand grenades down the open conning tower. The Germans presumably would be coming up to this innocent-looking fishing boat asking for fresh fish or fresh water, something like that, which was not unheard of, but not that likely either.
It's a great book. I have one final question, and then I'll let you go, because I know you're very busy. Do you think Hemingway was proud of what he did? And he did work for the U.S. too, so we should say that. But
I think the short answer is yes. He would have said it was all in the cause of anti-fascism. Mm-hmm. So he started before it became an accepted thing to do to fight fascism because of American neutrality. He's proud of what he did in Spain. He's proud of his relationship. He's proud of working with the Soviets against fascism. He's proud of working with the U.S. government against fascism. Where we take a footnote is he's uncomfortable with the formal relationship with the Soviets. So he entered into in 1940 and 1941. So I use the analogy, it's the difference between dating and getting married. Mm-hmm. So for Hemingway, the anti-fascist, the Soviets are great dates in Spain. You know, you have a common agenda, you do interesting things, it's glamorous, it's a little dangerous, but you're fighting the good fight, and you can do it on your own terms because you have no formal relationship. So they ask for ad hoc favors. He writes something for Pravda. He goes and talks to somebody who is is about to leave the fold. He goes on a guerrilla mission, thanks to the Soviet spies, and that's what drives the story, the plot of For Whom the Bell Tolls. Then, after the Soviets say, "Hey, do you want to make this a more formal relationship?" and he says yes, he almost immediately seems to realize, "Ooh, wait, this is different. You know, it's not easy come, easy go anymore." And if you've been dealing with the Soviets and reading the newspapers in the 30s, you know the Soviets aren't really easy breezy kind of people. and you don't really know, well, how do you get out of this relationship? Your question was he proud of it? He never loses his sympathy for the Soviets, but we do see him regretting the step of having a formal relationship with them. And that comes almost immediately because I think he realizes, hey, I'm an American author. And, you know, no matter whether the United States and the Soviet Union are friendly or even allies, it's still inconsistent with being this American, rugged American author and kind of a political activist of any sort. And then once the political climate changes and you see the Red Scare and the witch hunts in the late 40s and early 50s, that reinforces the same kind of thoughts, the thoughts that, well, you know, I'm Ernest Hemingway, the American writer. I don't want to get caught up in this. I want to be the American writer. I don't want to be a guy who appears before a committee. And that the House Un-American Activities Committee did have a file on him. So unfortunately, I don't have the second part of the file. I have the first part of the file, which shows that they were collecting on him. So they were trying to see how much how far to the left Hemingway had been and whether that would qualify, whether that would get him over the threshold. I don't have the second part, which has got to be the committee, the principals of the committee going, well, you know, who are we going to call this year? And I'm guessing that discussion did occur. It may not have been written down, but somebody seeing you went, oh, Ernest Hemingway, that's too hard a target for us. And all they had on him was his sympathy for the left, and nobody had until the 2000s, 2009 or so was when the book Spies was published with the excerpts from his Soviet file. Nobody had that for 69, 70 years. That secret kept, and that's a pretty good record. A for Ernest. The guy was discreet and professional about his relationship with the Soviets, and also, you know, we have to grudgingly. I don't think too many good thoughts about the Soviets at any time, but you have to sort of grudgingly respect them for being able to keep this secret for that long, because it is sort of a great secret. I mean, if you look at the guy who recruited Ernest in 1940, Jacob Golos, he's a real character. You could write a book on him, he's a gifted amateur. He's a semi-pro NKVD guy, not formally trained, but a lot of on-the-job experience. And he's living with Elizabeth Bentley from, a Vassar graduate who was an American communist. And he goes out to dinner with Ernest, recruits Ernest. Can you imagine you're coming home after recruiting the great American writer, and you somehow hold your tongue. You somehow don't say you won't believe who I just signed up. And I think he did. I think he kept his mouth shut because she told it. The evidence is that she, when she defected to the FBI, she told them virtually everything that she knew, which was mirrored by other sources. So, she was a great witness. She wasn't just a sort of a hearsay witness. Oh, we have one person here saying this contradicted. No, there were other people who supported that. And then there was a set of intercepts through a program called Venona of Soviet intelligence traffic, and that jibed with what she was saying. So I don't think he told her. I think he maintained professional discipline, and everyone kept this secret for 69 years.
Well, Nicholas Reynolds, we hope that maybe there's a volume 2 down the road, but this book, Writer, Sailor, Soldier, Spy, is wonderful. It is excellent, just meticulously researched. For my listeners, I just heartily recommend it. And it just gives this wonderful, revealing look of Ernest Hemingway that many probably have never seen before, considered, or even kind of thought through. And it was just wonderful to talk to you, Nicholas Reynolds, about the book, and congratulations on it, because I know it was a long time in research and work, and it's excellent. But we so appreciate your time. Thanks for joining us today on the
Not Better
Show.
Thank you.
And we hope you'll come back after Volume 2 is released.
Okay, we'll have to talk about that separately. I'm thinking of it.
Yeah, good. Well, we hope that you are, and we hope that you do. So thank you.
Thank you. Take care.
You too. Thanks. Thanks to all my guests today, all the help on the podcast and making me sound so much better. That is to say, not old, but better. Thanks to all.